Mark Lynch, Director of the Project on Middle East Political Science. Welcome to the Middle East Political Science Podcast. On this week's episode, we're going to talk to Courtney Freer of Emory University and the author of the brand new Oxford University Press book, The Resilience of Parliamentary Politics in Kuwait, Rentierism, Ideology, and Mobilization. Courtney, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So it's great to see this kind of in-depth treatment of Kuwaiti politics. I think there's a lot of stereotypes about the Gulf. And so it's good to see someone taking seriously, what's happening in the Kuwaiti parliament. Tell us a little bit about the origins of the book and what you were trying to accomplish when you wrote it.
Yeah, great. So I really wanted to bring Kuwait into broader political science conversations, especially about hybrid regimes. I think a lot of times, especially when it comes to the Gulf, the Gulf states are kind of treated as exceptional. You know, they're oil wealthy. Therefore, conversations that we have about political participation and mobilization in other places in the Middle East aren't as relevant when we look at the Gulf. And so I wanted to bring it into those conversations. And also, we didn't have really a comprehensive history of Kuwaiti parliament in English. And so I wanted to provide that as well.
And so this really does like go through like the entire history of post-independence Kuwait. Tell us a little bit about how you did the research, the sources, you know, what you were basing your work on.
Yeah, great. So I had spent some time in, I've been obsessed with Kuwait for about the past decade. So I did my PhD work. Part of it, I was focused on Kuwait and spent time interviewing members of the Muslim Brotherhood there. So I had kind of these links already established with many kind of Islamists within Kuwait. And over the course of my time working at the London School of Economics, I was working with the Kuwait program. And so I had the opportunity to travel to Kuwait 4 times a year. And so when I would go, I would have the opportunity to speak with a variety of people from different political backgrounds, from scholarly backgrounds as well. And it really helped me to gain access to primary sources in terms of kind of oral history, but also primary sources in Arabic. So I would get a lot of kind of self-published manuscripts or other books that I could not have gained access to outside of Kuwait. And so that really helped me a lot. To kind of build up my knowledge about things on kind of the local level.
No, that's great. So one of the big arguments of the book then is, as you said a minute ago, that that you really don't think it's right to simply describe Kuwait as an autocracy or even just as a monarchy. You think that it's a much more complex political system than that. Tell us a little bit about that and the literature that you're engaging with and why you came to that conclusion.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the literature when it comes to the Gulf focuses on, I guess, a couple of things. One would be kind of regime politics and the idea that, you know, going off of rentier state theory, that if you have an oil wealthy state, the state becomes A, the most powerful economic actor, and B, the most powerful political actor. And I think Kuwait really beautifully shows the limits of that theory and the limits of what political, what oil wealth can do in terms of buying political quiescence. So I kind of used that as a jumping off point, this idea that oil wealth is maybe not the explanatory, the main explainer for political behavior within these kind of states. So that was one thing that I really wanted to show is the idea that parliament doesn't just exist also as a means of dispersing benefits to people in Kuwaiti society. I think that's one very common strand of thought that we see about Kuwait. And so that was kind of one area in which I was engaging. I guess the other is this idea of hybrid regimes and placing Kuwait more as a hybrid regime and less as an autocracy, and really engaging in the ways in which, yes, the emir does hold substantial amounts of political power, but you also have a parliament that's very vocal and is very active. And if you look at Kuwait's constitution, which, you know, Kuwaiti political politicians always refer back to the constitution, you see how much power is given to Kuwaiti parliament. And that's not on accident, right? Like that is a purposeful document. That's an important document. And I go into a little bit kind of why that is the case. And we can talk about that a little bit more later. But I really wanted to question previous understandings of Kuwait just as this oil wealthy autocratic state in which politics just surround issues of disbursement.
And one of the things which has always fascinated me about Kuwaiti Parliament, and that really comes through in your narrative and also in your theoretical discussion, is the extent to which so much of the argument is simply about the power of the Parliament and whether or not it can interrogate or interpolate members of the royal family, and the ongoing battles over whether that will be permitted and the terms of it. So, does that kind of get to your point about what makes this a hybrid regime, this notion of the kind of uncertain, highly contested boundaries of where the royal family's prerogatives end?
Yes, absolutely. I think if you look at some instances in Kuwait of questioning ministers who are members of the ruling family. I mean, this is something we wouldn't see. It's not imaginable in other Gulf states. I think one of the most important examples that shows kind of the hybridity of this regime, it comes from 2006, and Kuwaiti Parliament has the authority to approve of succession. And so in 2006, when the emir came to power and was quite ill, Kuwaiti Parliament voted to grant temporary authority to the prime minister on the grounds that Sheikh Saud was too ill to take the oath of succession. And I mean, there's nothing kind of more hybrid than that. The idea that Parliament can step in on issues of succession, which in other Gulf states are held completely behind closed doors. And, there no legislature would have a say like that. So I think you see, I mean, that's, I think, probably the best example of the power that Parliament has, but we see it kind of continuously. And even the fact that this gridlock exists today between kind of an appointed cabinet and an elected parliament shows the extent to which parliamentary process matters and parliamentary composition matters.
I mean, at one point, they managed to force the resignation or the removal of a prime minister.
Yes, exactly. In around kind of the Arab Spring period. And so this is not, I believe Fred Wary said about Bahrain, it's a toothless debating society. This is not the case in Kuwait. I mean, yes, it's difficult for policies to be made, but oftentimes there are very real discussions about the limits, placing limits on executive power, which you would not see in other institutions in the Gulf, or I think in the Middle East more broadly.
And then on the other side, of course, it's not like the ruling family or the regime, takes this lying down. They're constantly trying to manipulate and create the kind of parliament they want, although they aren't necessarily always able to do so.
Yes, absolutely. And I talk a little bit, I mean, I guess I talk a lot throughout the book about the ways in which electoral law has changed in Kuwait. So you've had redistricting in 1981, you've had redistricting in 2006, which was actually at the demands of a broad-based opposition movement. And then in 2012, the emir introduced the single non-transferable vote system, which has been which actually spurred an opposition boycott for 4 years and has been at the center of a lot of complaint of members of the opposition. So you do have a regime which knows the ways of kind of controlling the rules of the game in a sense. And I think in that sense, it's somewhat similar to the Jordanian regime in this idea of like manipulating the way that elections are held rather than just canceling them kind of outright. And also there have been periods in which Kuwaiti Parliament has been dissolved unconstitutionally. So meaning that it has been dissolved without a new date for its election being set. This happened from 1976 until 1981, and then from 1986 until 1991. So we do have instances in which executive power has definitely curtailed legislative power. But it has always produced, I would say, large-scale mobilization and protests because of how central parliament is to Kuwaiti politics.
And there's multiple sources of kind of locations of power as well. I think one of my favorite examples was when there was a troublesome parliament, and then it ends up getting dissolved because the constitutional court rules that the previous one was illegally dissolved.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the role of the judiciary in Kuwaiti politics is something that's really fascinating, and I think could be the topic of a whole other book because we've had a couple instances in recent history when the Constitutional Court has stepped in to dissolve Parliament, but also so the Emir and the Constitutional Court both have that power, but also you have courts stepping in terms of whether deciding whether candidates are able to contest elections because there was an issue in the early 2010s about whether politicians who or candidates who had insulted the Emir would and had been prosecuted for that could contest parliamentary seats. So the judicial lines here are very important as well.
Now, a lot of the book is organized historically around the different eras. Before we get to that, though, maybe you could say a little bit about kind of what's going on in Parliament in general. So the kind of the evolution of the different blocks you don't have political parties, but you have blocks. Tell us a little bit about what is happening on the political side of parliamentary life.
Yeah, great question. So as you mentioned, there isn't a political party law. This is one thing that a lot of members of the opposition think would help in terms of creating a parliament that can work together in which coalitions can form rather than having a lot of independent personalities vying for political control and for political voice. So I mean, in terms of parliament can propose and put forward legislation. So this is a big part of what it does. It has a variety of different committees, which then voice their opinions about various issues. In the last parliament, there was this commission that was meant to give suggestions about n a new electoral commission, a new electoral, like changes to the electoral system writ large. So there are very real discussions being had about policy. A big thing that parliament does is it can oversee public finances. So a lot of times this is where you get this discussion about linked to rentierism, the idea that parliament really wants to secure massive increases in public sector salaries, for instance. And there have been times when this has happened, and this has led to the dissolution of parliament recently because parliament was agitating for something which cabinet was unable and un or unwilling to provide in terms of material disbursement. So there are conversations about material disbursements, about preserving the social welfare benefits that citizens are used to. But there are also conversations about placing limits on executive authority through, for instance, changing the electoral law, changing electoral districts, and also through interpolating members of the cabinet. And just one brief thing on interpolation, and one of the reasons that it happens so often is that any member of parliament for any reason can propose to interpolate a member of the cabinet. And so this can range from a personal gripe to an ideological political pro or ideological issue with a member of cabinet. And so you end up having a variety of types of political clashes, I think, between parliament and cabinet, as well as just a lot of clashes in general.
I mean, one of the things which is like comes through really interestingly, and we'll talk about this a bit later, is Islamists and Salafis, they're often advancing these conservative social positions and things on gender and family and Sharia and that sort of thing. But you also have a number of other issues which seem to be through lines through the all these parliamentary debates and issues. Can you maybe just flag a few of those for us? Things that are kind of like running through historically and kind of up to where we are now with this like loyalist opposition division.
Yeah, sure. And I would say just as a, I guess I should say from the outset, the idea of defining the opposition in Kuwaiti politics is really difficult because it does shift. And also when you have the vast majority of seats in parliament going to opposition members, sometimes we'll see splinters within opposition in general as well. So that it's hard to it there's a difficulty with labeling. But I would say in general, as you mentioned, we do have Islamist blocs, Salafi blocs, Muslim Brotherhood bloc, which often agitate for certain social policy reforms. And this can often break up opposition unity, which may have otherwise existed between secular and Islamist strands of the opposition. You also have, I would say, generally this focus on fighting corruption, potentially prerogatives held by the ruling family, and that is often portrayed through the lens of like secular nationalism or Arab nationalism, but it can also be portrayed through the lens of kind of a present day, this broad-based political opposition, which sees itself as having a responsibility of placing checks on executive power, essentially. So I think that's another strand. I do think another thing that's interesting in Kuwait is the idea that parliament does comment on foreign policy issues. So it doesn't make treaties, doesn't sign the treaties and all, but it does. I mean, for instance, Kuwaiti Parliament has voted for a very strong boycott law concerning Israel. And this is qualitatively different from what we would see in parliaments in other parts of the region, which don't necessarily comment on issues related to foreign policy. And I think there's kind of I guess it's kind of the strand that ties this together throughout the history of Kuwaiti Parliament would be a focus on, I guess, backing what are seen as, I guess, Arab causes, pan-Arab causes in foreign policy in general. But and I guess the one other thing would be this idea of maintaining the social contract between the ruling family and the citizens in terms of maintaining maintaining access to public sector jobs, maintaining access to free education and healthcare, things like that, the prerogatives of citizens, which has become more of an important political issue, I'd say, as the expatriate population has increased over the years.
Yeah, the citizen non-citizen gulf is kind of across the gulf is always going to be one of those major themes. And that, of course, includes like the question of the Bedouin and the stateless and where they fit within all of that.
Yes. And the Bedouin, that's another a good point to bring up as another issue that has really emerged kind of over many periods and over many parliaments. So you have, because citizenship attaches with it, these very, very important financial benefits. Citizenship has been restricted in Kuwait, and not only in Kuwait, throughout the Gulf states. This is something quite common. And in the redefinition of various citizenship over the years, you have this population of Bedouin, so people Bedouin jinsia without a nationality, who are unable to gain access to the public, employment, to gaining IDs, to leaving the country, all kinds of things, because they're unable to produce the paperwork that would demonstrate that their families had been in Kuwait at the time, needed to show that they have citizenship. And so a lot of various, I would say, speakers of parliament over the years have produced different plans for how to manage this population, which in terms of the numbers, I think it's around 100,000. It's really difficult to know, though. And there is this department that deals with, the issue of the Bedouin, and is trying to resolve it. But of course, this also has a huge political consequence, because if you're naturalizing 100,000 people, these are 100,000 new voters. And that's a really important political dynamic that it is not lost on people who are trying to make the decisions about how to manage this population.
Yeah, and the nature of the electorate is an interesting question. I remember you mentioned that the original elections were adult men who could trace their lineage back to 1920. It's only 2006 that women are finally allowed to vote.
Yeah, exactly. So there has been, I guess, a gradual opening in a sense of kind of the electorate, but it is still limited in terms of citizens, women only recently. And I think we saw also in the recent elections in Qatar of the Shura Council, this idea of like how a state defines citizenship has major political consequences and consequences for its relationships, especially with tribal populations who may not have been naturalized as early on as more of the urbanized populations. And so that's something that I think is also common throughout the Gulf, this idea of who should vote, who should have the right to vote, and why. In Kuwait, it's a 70% expatriate population, 30% Kuwaiti population. And that's there's a lot of discussion in Parliament, I would say, in recent years about rather they will always say correcting the demographic imbalance and kind of Kuwaitizing the workforce, having more Kuwaitis involved in the public sector in particular. So there, this idea of like nationality and citizenship is also something that's really, really important, I would say, throughout the years in Kuwait.
So one of the things which is really interesting about the book is that, as you mentioned, typically Kuwait's parliament and Kuwait's political life is seen as something kind of bizarre in the context of the Gulf. And one of the things that I take your book to be trying to do is to say, yeah, but actually it's kind of normal in the context of hybrid authoritarian regimes. And if you stop treating it as kind of an exceptional thing in the Gulf and as part of normal political science, you can kind of see some of these dynamics. At the same time, the rentier state, oil wealth, the GCC context, it is kind of exceptional. How did you thread that needle in terms of thinking about, kind of what needs to be explained when you're looking at the Kuwaiti parliament?
Yeah, great question. I think one goal is to bring Kuwait into conversation with states outside of the Gulf. So not just seeing it in conversation within its, in comparison with its neighbors, though I just did compare it to its neighbors. So, it's hard to avoid that, right? So I think that's one thing, this idea that we can learn something about Kuwait that is relevant to cases of in countries that are not oil wealthy. But at the same time, I think one thing you can't ignore is the fact that this is a very wealthy state, and a state in which citizens are accustomed to receiving handsome disbursements. So high paying public sector jobs. I think the stats are something like, 90% of the public sector, or 90% of Kuwaitis work in the public sector, something very high. This idea that people are used to getting jobs from the state. You have healthcare, education, you have expectations of housing, but there's kind of a housing crisis in Kuwait that we can get into. But in any case, the point is that there are high expectations among Kuwaiti citizens of what they will get from their state. And so when we have seen oil prices lower, so in 2014 and then in 2020 with COVID, I mean, we do see some calls for austerity, being that the cabinet or the government mm-hmm. says, we really do need to cut back. And this is something you wouldn't see in other states, right? So in states that aren't as reliant on oil wealth, and Kuwait is still very much reliant on oil wealth for its mm-hmm. income, the international oil markets matter and affect domestic politics. And so when we have seen these calls for austerity, oftentimes parliament has pushed back against them. And one way to push back that we've seen, I think, in recent years is this kind of xenophobic call for mm-hmm. placing the burden of austerity not on Kuwaitis, but on expats. There was one MP infamously said that expatriates should be charged for the air they breathe. So it's this idea that the burden for payment should not to never lie on Kuwaitis because they, belong to this place. So I think that's something, that dynamic of oil wealth and also the dynamic of expatriate majority population. I think those are things that make Kuwait distinct, but I don't think those things are so different that we cannot compare Kuwait, say, with mm-hmm. other hybrid regimes like Morocco or Jordan.
There was one striking moment, kind of, I think this was in like the 2010s, but I can't remember exactly. But you mentioned that relative to its neighbors, Kuwait does quite poorly on attracting FDI, foreign direct investment. And you get the parliamentarian saying, look, this is because of all the corruption. It's all the same issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is a common thing. I think it was the Dow petrochemical deal. There was a deal that was supposed to go through, I believe it was 2008, and essentially mm-hmm. the parliament had voted against it. And so, and they said they had that there were a variety of different economic reasons, that this was not a sustainable agreement. But I think others said, well, parliament is actually holding back the development of Kuwait because you have merchant families in parliament who are trying to protect their access to massive contracts and to accruing more wealth. And so there is also, I mean, I think you'll hear this in the Gulf that, people in the Emirates will say, well, look at, we don't want what's happening in Kuwait. Or if, I guess, you see the way that diversification has taken place in the Emirates very quickly. You look at what's happening in Saudi with Vision 2030, and Kuwait is not, not diversifying as quickly as those states. And a lot of times people will blame, including Kuwaitis, will blame Parliament for that. I mean, just recently Kuwait pushed back its Vision 2035 to Vision 2040, which, indicates that there's not much progress being made on this. And this is, it is helpful for the monarchy to blame parliament for some of this. Certainly, if you can't just make top-down decisions, it delays implementation oftentimes. And I think we have seen that in cases in Kuwait.
To be fair, Saudi Arabia just downgraded the NEOM project from what, 120 kilometers to 5 kilometers or something like that. So autocracy doesn't always work either. But we've been speaking with Courtney Freer about her book, The Resilience of Parliamentary Politics in Kuwait. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the history of the parliament and how it's evolved over the years. We're back with Courtney Freer to talk about the historical evolution of Kuwait's parliament. And one of the things which is really interesting in the book, which I guess I knew, but I've kind of forgotten, which is that the origins of this lie in the pre-independence period and nationalist and Arab nationalist mobilization. Tell us a little bit about this, because I think it sheds some insight into why Kuwaitis are so attached to their parliament.
Yeah, definitely. And I Kuwaiti nationalists kind of existed prior to independence in 1961. So you do see, kind of the creation of, or the the cultivation of these Arab nationalist networks within Kuwait in the 50s. Talal al-Rashid is doing some really great work connecting Palestinian nationalists and Kuwaiti nationalists over the years, kind of in this time in the 50s, especially through the education system. And so you had in Kuwait a movement that wanted to become independent of the British protectorate, that really was pushing for this. And that is qualitatively different from what we see even in some of the other Gulf states. And so you did have this desire, this very self-conscious desire to have an independent Kuwait. And I would say also just briefly, not to take us back too far in history, but you know, there was back in 1938, a merchants majlis. So there was this desire kind of early on for consensus-based politics to be a part of the arrangement with the al-Sabah ruling family. And that is also qualitatively different from what we see in other states. And so I think, you know, some scholars will say that the reason Kuwait has a parliament is, you know, due to the outside threat from Iraq. I would say that this has been something that the grassroots has wanted, kind of in Kuwait, the politically active members of the grassroots, a lot of them urban folks who are active in the Arab nationalist movement, have kind of agitated for this from an early period. So from the 1930s, there's been a desire to have some checks on the power of the ruling family. And we see that borne out through independence in the 1961 and then the establishment of the parliament.
And the constitution was pretty carefully negotiated at this transitional moment.
Yes, absolutely. So the constitution also, I mean, if you read it, you'll see that it is a remarkable document. It's also something that there's a reason that the Kuwaiti opposition always goes back to this constitution. And at the time that it was drafted, there was a thought that, you know, the Emir Sheikh Abdullah was somewhat, you know, kind of liberal or left-leaning in the sense that it was okay that Kuwaiti society writ large had some kind of say in what was happening politically. And so you did have, you know, kind of permission for relatively, I would say, democratic language in the Kuwaiti constitution.
So then you have a constitution, you have this parliament, and we all know that rulers don't really like having constraints put on their power. This is also pre the oil boom.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, and this is something also I think that, you know, maybe this complicates our notion of like how much oil wealth really matters, because you do have these kind of checks put on the ruling family relatively early on. And then it's only in the 1970s when Parliament comes into the conversation about, you know, how exactly should all of this oil wealth be spent? Mm-hmm. You know, to what extent, you know, does this belong to all Kuwaitis rather than just to the ruling family? And because you had this institution in place, which had actual checks on executive power, you don't have a situation in which, you know, the people at the top are taking all of the money from themselves and not creating this social safety net. And I think Stefan Hertog and Ferdinand Eibel have done some work on like varieties of rentierism, and that, you know, you can have a situation in which there is no social safety net provided. And because Kuwait had this institution, it evolved in a very different way.
Now, you know, you trace this through those debates in the 1970s. But then when the Iranian Revolution hits, that has kind of changes the way the royal family views the Islamists and the Shia community as well. So how does that impact the parliament?
Yeah, so in the 60s, the main opposition group in parliament was Arab nationalists, as we saw kind of throughout the region. Over the course of the 1970s, we had seen the rise of Islam, a variety of different types of Islamists. So especially Sunni Islamists, Salafis joined, you know, kind of elections in 1981. But what we saw early on was even among Sunni Islamists, there were, and this is true throughout the region, there was, you know, support for the Iranian Revolution because it was a fundamentally Islamist project, regardless of the fact that it was Shia rather than Sunni. And so that did, you know, kind of worry the government, obviously. And you also have in Kuwait a Shia minority population, which is maybe around 20-ish% of the population. And so this is not a negligible percentage of the population. You also have during this period, you know, not, you know, around after, I mean, 1979, you also have the Lebanese Civil War ongoing. You also have 1980, Iran-Iraq War. So there's this kind of concern, I would say, at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, that Kuwait could be drawn into regional instability, partly because of its demographic makeup. And so there was more concern, especially about the Shia population, I would say, moving into the 1980s. And I would say also a desire for the government to try to co-opt Sunni Islamists by allowing them, you know, some wins when it comes to social policies, but obviously not going so far as to, change the government system completely. So I think there were renegotiations with Islamists during this period.
And then, of course, you have like the big moment in modern Kuwaiti history, the Iraqi invasion and this, this devastation of the country's infrastructure and population and everything. And I think that, in some ways you push back against the notion, though, that this leads to a complete reinvention of Kuwaiti politics. And so tell us a little bit about this and kind of how Kuwait is remade and where the continuity is after the Iraqis are forced out and, liberated by the United States and the coalition.
Yeah, so I think that we do see continuity in the sense that the same actors really who were important in Kuwait pre-invasion were important after. So in particular, I've done a lot of work on the Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood networks were important in terms of parts of the resistance and also being parts of the resistance abroad, publicizing what was happening in Kuwait to people elsewhere to get kind of political will to liberate Kuwait, essentially. And so you did have that. You also have, during this period, I would say what changes is there's this rally around the flag effect, right? So in the 1980s, there had been somewhat suspicion of the Shia population. Once the invasion happens, it's very clear that there is, kind of loyalty, to the regime. And this is across demographic lines. So I think that's one other shift that you see. I think also there is this shift in the opposition in the sense that the ruling family was in Saudi Arabia. So the ruling family was not in Kuwait. Many Kuwaitis, the invasion happened in August. Many Kuwaitis were outside of the country. And there does emerge this rift kind of between Kuwaitis who stayed or who were there during the resistance and during the occupation and then others who were gone. And Marianne Tetreault, I think, covers this really well in her book in this idea that Kuwaitis, after they kind of fought the invasion of Saddam Hussein, felt more emboldened to stand up to the ruling family and to demand that parliament would be restored when they were concerned that maybe this would not be the case. So I do think that it emboldened the opposition, but I do think we see largely continuity in terms of same groups, same individuals, even in a lot of cases being active and involved in Kuwaiti politics before and after the invasion.
I mean, it might not affect the elections, but there's also the huge demographic change of the expulsion of the Palestinians and Jordanians and a lot of the Arab workers, replacing them with South Asians. You see that kind of across the Gulf, but in Kuwait, it was particularly extreme.
Yes, and I think this process of moving away from having Arab expats happen started in the 1980s because there was suspicion or there was concern about Kuwait being drawn into kind of external events that were happening throughout the region. But certainly after 1991, we see the expulsion of tens of thousands of Palestinians in particular because of the position that the PLO had taken vis-a-vis the American involvement in the liberation of Kuwait. And so there is this shift that we see in the 1990s, certainly. And it's I would say, also this is a remarkable event when we look at the region. I mean, this is the only state that has had in very recent memory an experience of invasion and occupation. And I think that's often overlooked when we just talk about Kuwait as being just this oil wealthy country.
No, and that's a really excellent point. And there's been increasing amount of literature on that, which I think is really important for understanding maybe some of the things that make Kuwait different. And also that I think one of the, you don't really, make this point directly, but it comes through, is that this isn't just like the Americans said, okay, you're going to have a democracy now because we liberated you. There's a lot more history and indigenous roots to this than that narrative would suggest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to push back against that narrative of the Kuwaiti parliament was restored because of outside powers. I mean, there were a lot of Kuwaitis who, most Kuwaitis, in fact, wanted the restoration of parliament and had wanted that since, 1986. You had before the invasion of Kuwait, the Monday night Diwaniyat meetings in which people basically were agitating for the return of parliament. So there was this grassroots campaign. And indeed, some of the literature says that Saddam Hussein believed that Kuwaitis were so fed up with the government because it hadn't restored parliament that they would be okay with him coming in. And so so there was certainly this agitation early on. And so I push back against the idea that parliament came back just because the Americans wanted it to come back.
So I want to jump ahead a little bit to the 2000s, because you As you go through the 90s and the 2000s, there's a lot of like interesting elections and people can read about them and changes of the election law and all of that. But one of the things which is so interesting about Kuwait in the 2000s is that you see the emergence of some of the kind of a number of youth-led kind of social movements, which I think are very much in line with what you're seeing elsewhere in the region. But of course, they have real Kuwaiti, you know, distinctiveness. And there's the Orange Movement, a couple of others. But maybe talk about this and how this changes kind of the game of parliamentary politics.
Yeah, definitely. So I think this also, I would date this kind of broad-based opposition social movement kind of to the 1990s, to kind of post-invasion Kuwait, and this idea that the opposition is willing to come together to fight what it sees as abuse of power on behalf of the state. And so in 2006, you had the Orange Movement, or the We Want Five movement, the movement that successfully agitated for a change in the electoral districting in such a way that it was felt that this was much more representative, made vote buying more difficult. Mm-hmm. So we have the use of protests kind of from the early 2000s, like pre-Arab Spring. We also have in 2011, the Irhal or Leave movement, which was against a specific prime minister who's a member of the ruling family who did eventually leave office.
Irhal after will become such a popular phrase so soon after that.
Exactly. So there we do have these grassroots movements happening. And I think this is one other thing I wanted to capture in the book is that, yes, parliament is important. And yes, institutions are important, but they're not the whole story. And again, Marianne Tetreault's work on Kuwait shows this a lot. The idea that you know, grassroots organizing is happening in Diwaniyat, you know, in other aspects of society. I mean, also in on university campuses. So there are very real political conversations happening outside of parliament, and those have impacts on what happens within parliament. So you also have Karamat Watan in 2012, the nation's dignity mm-hmm. protest. So there, and that brought in kind of a new demographic to these protests. You have young people from tribal backgrounds being involved in protests as well. And you have kind of a shift in terms of, you know, where in the past tribal constituents were seen as more loyal. As we go on in the 2000s and 2010s, we see more and more tribal youth in particular joining the political opposition, basically saying that they're kind of marginalized politically, socially, economically in the Kuwaiti system. So we do see these kind of grassroots protest movements emerging. The fact that these can emerge and do emerge is you know, remarkable in and of itself, and I think is not something that, you know, rentier state theory would necessarily have predicted. But these protests do matter, and they do, I think, do still take place when there is a sense of threat on parliament or mm-hmm. or on kind of popular participation in politics.
Since you brought it up, maybe we should jump over briefly to this whole Badu Hadar distinction, which is so often invoked when talking about Kuwaiti politics. And in the book, and also in the article you did with Andrew Lieber, you really push back against this some of the idea that this is kind of a fixed, kind of continuous thing in Kuwaiti politics. But tell us a little bit about, you know, tribal primaries and, you know, the whole discourse around that.
Yeah, so I would say there's a discourse in Kuwait, and this has been the case, I would say maybe back to the 80s, this idea that there is a so-called tribal advantage. So, you know, tribal groups have the advantage of being geographically proximate to one another, and so they can organize their vote shares. They also use informal institutions like tribal meetings and tribal primaries, in which a tribe will basically meet and decide on whom their candidate will be. And so there is this idea that they're very good, uniquely good at voter coordination and mobilization in a way that maybe is unfair to other groups that don't have the same kind of social cohesion. Mm-hmm. And there's also, I think I would say, the urban Kuwaiti population would say, well, there's this tribalization of politics in whereby tribal politicians solely want to secure material disbursements for members of their tribes. And so you have this phenomenon of the so-called service MPs, the idea that these members of tribes go in to secure disbursements for their outlying districts for material purposes. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's more to that. And we mm-hmm. see more and more tribal MPs like Musalam al-Barak quite famously Badr al-Dahum, other kind of tribal MPs who have made statements against even tribal primaries. Musalim al-Barak said he thought they were unfair and undemocratic, so he didn't participate, and he still won a very high vote share. So we have this shift, I would say, away from the model of the service MP. I don't know that it's not completely gone. Not mean to say that it doesn't exist anymore, but I think you see a movement of some members of tribes being part of the broad-based political opposition and stating and making statements about placing limits on executive power rather than just making these statements about disbursement. And I think this idea of them having a distinctive advantage, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Andrew and I basically looked at the vote share that tribes gain in Kuwait, and what we found is that tribes are not overrepresented in the system writ large. They're kind of overrepresented in two districts, in the outlying districts in which they're the majority population. But this concern about tribes kind of taking right. over politics in Kuwait, I think, is exaggerated.
Now, why don't we continue on this theme, not of the tribes, but the Islamists. I mean, you've previously written about this, your previous book was about this. And in this book, you really do talk about kind of the party side of this with Islam Constitutional Movement, the Ummah Party. So tell us a little bit about how the Islamists and Salafis have played this parliamentary game and how they've evolved.
Yeah, so so Islamism in Kuwait is fascinating. So I could go, I will try not to go on, but I could go on. In Kuwait, we have in 1981, Haraki Salafis contesting parliamentary elections and kind of coming into the right of,
which is really
of the
unusual.
Muslim Brotherhood. Yeah, extremely unusual. And I believe that's the first instance of Haraki Salafis contesting elections in Kuwait. So it's also this really important, I would say, ideological contribution of Salafis in Kuwait, of this idea that you can participate in politics and that, you know, perhaps you should participate in politics. And so I think we've seen over the years the proliferation of new Salafi groups. And also, I would say in recent years, there's more splintering of these Salafi blocks. And so we see more and more independent Salafis advocating for primarily for social policy changes. So we do have that side of the Islamist scene. Back in the 2022 election, several members of Salafi groups signed onto something called a values document, in which they advocated for a variety of changes to social policies, things like criminalizing tattoos and stopping gender segregation. Mm-hmm. So they're really involved types of debates. In Kuwait, one thing that's come up time and time again is gender segregation at Kuwait University, that has been enforced kind of more strictly in recent years after the most recent parliament brought that out. So we do have Salafi participation, Muslim Brotherhood participation, Shia Islamist blocs as well do participate in parliament. And interestingly, they are actually seen as loyalist groups. So you have a variety of, I would say, of political groups that have some kind of ideological or communal basis. And this is, you know, different from just seeing these groups as jockeying for material disbursements or just representing people's ascriptive identities, I would say.
Okay, so the title of the book is The Resilience of Parliamentary Life. But I mean, anyone looking at Kuwait's parliament over the last, you know, 5-10 years has to be struck by just how rocky it has been and the constantly being dissolved and the constant crises and paralysis. And I think Kuwaitis that I know are pretty frustrated with their parliament. How do you assess like what's been happening in recent years and how that fits into this broader trajectory?
Yeah, great question. And I will say, I mean, I've had some sleepless nights about the title. So, so I mean, we'll see kind of how it turns out. But I do think that there is a commitment, you know, just notwithstanding the frustrations with the inability of parliament and cabinet to work together, the inability of parliament to agree on certain policies, regardless of that, I do think that there is a commitment to and a pride in having a parliament and having a parliament that matters. Mm-hmm. And I do think every time we've seen a threat or a perceived threat on parliamentary life, We see protests, we see a response. I also think one thing that's telling is the last election that took place just last week, which was the fourth since 2020, saw a high turnout, 62% turnout. So if people truly didn't see the utility in this institution, they likely wouldn't turn out to vote over and over and over again. And I think this also speaks to, you know, political science literature about electoral fatigue and calling repeated elections as a means of undermining opposition. So I would say that. I mean, also, I think now it's a really interesting moment because we're seeing the emir proposing to push back the start date of parliament to next month. And we're seeing tons of opposition to this on Twitter in public statements. So I think that, you know, I do think that parliamentary life in Kuwait is resilient. I think commitment to parliament is resilient. Do I think that the model could be changed and that rules could be changed to make it a more productive relationship between parliament and cabinet? Absolutely. And hopefully that's something that does happen.
So four elections in 4 years, like what are the issues? What are they being done under different laws? Are they just like fighting over the same issues with the same cast of characters? You know, what's been happening?
Yeah, so great question. I mean, it's largely been over very similar issues. So there will be a dissolution of parliament, either due to disagreement, inability of cabinet and parliament to make agreements on specific policies or on policies in general. There'll often be resignations of members of cabinet say, you know, this parliament won't allow us to get anything done. We can't deal with it. So it's this tension, I would say, between cabinet and parliament and is at the heart of this, as at the heart of most of these dissolutions. And this idea of basically also the most recent dissolution, I would say, was a little bit more about maintaining the prerogative of the emir, maintaining the prerogative of unelected segments of parliament, but I think a lot of government rather. But I think that there is this fundamental kind of push and pull between a parliament that wants to maintain its authority and a ruling family and a cabinet that wants to maintain its authority. So in a lot of the campaigns, what you see is a focus on fighting corruption, a focus on providing good governance, a lot of discussion about reforms of the political system, whether that's through changing the single non-transferable vote system, that's a big one, or changing or introducing a female quota, or whatever the case, or introducing a political parties law. So that's a conversation that's being had, is how to change the electoral system. This is something that's talked about in these agendas. You'll also have some campaign agendas related to to Islamist platforms. So the idea that the state needs to take a stand on protecting Islamic values and traditions. So that's another strand that you'll see throughout. But a lot of focus on, I would say, good governance, transparency, economic reform, especially about diversification, and reforming the political system in a way that can make it more functional.
I mean, last question is that, you know, after a long period of continuity, there's been a succession of transfers of royal power as one emir after the other has passed away and been replaced by someone of the same generation. At some point, presumably, succession is going to have to go vertically to a new generation. And you describe in the book a number of initiatives and pressures for the creation of constitutional monarchy and that sort of thing. Is that something that might be on the horizon? I mean, it's impossible to predict the future, but given a generational transfer at the emir level and this, what parliament is trying to do, you know, is that a reasonable possibility?
I'm not sure I would expect it in kind of the near term. I think, I mean, one thing that's really interesting and different from what we've seen in the other succession from Sheikh Sabah to Sheikh Nawaf and then Nawaf to Mishal is that since Sheikh Mishal took power in December, we still don't have a crown prince who's been named. And so this suggests that, you know, maybe this is the moment of generational shift and that there's like anxiety or hesitation about that. I have misjudged basically every next crown prince. So I'm not going to, you know, having already put myself out there about the resilience of parliamentary life, I'm not going to predict kind of who the next crown prince will be. But I mean, there's a lot of, if you look at a family tree, it kind of does have to go to the next generation, but this raises the question of, you know, who is a viable candidate? For instance, Mohammed Nasser Sabah, one of the prime minister who was faced down in the Irhal movement, you know, someone like that, if you bring him back, he has a really fraught relationship with the opposition kind of from previous political action. So one of the issues I think we've seen is that when you've had emirs who have been actively involved in political life, whether as prime ministers or as ministers, they sometimes have had clashes with parliament. And what we see with Sheikh Nawaf and Sheikh Mishal is that they've been more involved in the security sector. And so they haven't had as much interaction with parliament, which means two things. It means one, that we know less about their policy preferences. Mm-hmm. And two, they haven't had the opportunity to have these clashes with parliament that other other emirs or ministers rather have had in the past. And so it'll be interesting to see whether that's something that continues moving forward, that the training ground for emirs will not be in ministerial positions because there's too big of a threat of being interpolated and mm-hmm. ruining the relationship with parliament, or whether, you know, the new training ground will be from the security sector. So I think that's something to look out for, as well as this generational shift. Sheikh Mishal, I believe, is 83 and came to power when he was, 83. So, and was named crown prince when he was 81. So there's kind of running out of this current generation. So we'll see what happens next. And of course, the parliament will approve. I mean, perhaps this parliament will be the one who will approve the crown prince was brought in. Yeah.
So as a last question, that was kind of a curveball. So let me give you a last question, which is more of like a slow pitch softball, which is that, you know, watching Kuwait from the Gulf, you often hear commentators and intellectuals kind of crowing about how Kuwait proves that democracy doesn't work and why their autocratic systems are so much better. From reading the book, I take it you wouldn't agree, but tell us why.
I think that one of the reasons that this is important is that we have information about political opinion, about public opinion. We know, and I think this is important for authoritarian or semi-authoritarian governments to know what the policy preferences are of your population, what your approval rating is. Kind of broadly speaking, you could kind of figure that out when you have elections and you have elections that matter. So I think that in terms of knowing more about the population, this is something that's valuable and something that's important. I think it also provides some, you know, level of buy-in to the system that maybe you wouldn't have if you felt that elections were meaningless. And I do think, go back to this idea, is that, you know, for as much as even Kuwaitis will complain about the system, and this idea, I mean, Abdullah Nafisi described domestic politics in Kuwait as carnival, right? This idea that there's a free-for-all and there's this gridlock between parliament and cabinet. Despite that, I do think that it's important that people feel that they have some voice in what happens in political life. And I think that is a more sustainable model than just having this top-down model in which you know very little about policy preferences of your citizens. You know very little about ideologies that have a mobilizational capacity because you don't allow mobilization. And I think providing some kind of release of public frustrations with the government, providing some kind of institutional outlet for them it will fundamentally create a longer lasting kind of potentially, hopefully more functional relationship between elected and unelected segments of government.
We've been speaking with Courtney Freer of Emory University about her new book, The Resilience of Parliamentary Politics in Kuwait. Thanks for listening to the Political Science Podcast.